I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. At this hour, officials and a grieving public are gathering at Thomas Paine Plaza in Center City, Philadelphia. They're holding a vigil for the victims of Sunday's shooting in Las Vegas. WHYY's Aaron Moselle is there, and he joins me now on the line. Aaron, describe the scene.
The event here is underway at this point with the head of Ceasefire PA sort of giving opening remarks. This is one of at least a couple vigils scheduled in the city tonight following Sunday's mass shooting in Las Vegas that, as we've heard, has claimed the lives of nearly five dozen people. This one here at Thomas Paine Plaza across from City Hall is being dubbed Standing with Las Vegas and was organized by, as I said, Ceasefire. They're a statewide group that works to reduce gun violence and the flow of illegal guns. And there's about three dozen people here so far. A rabbi I talked to before the program got underway said he was here to sort of pray for the victims of Las Vegas, but also to sort of call on elected officials to, you know, beef up gun control measures. That was a refrain kind of echoed by a lot of folks here that, they want to express their sadness and their grief, but they also want to know what's next here. On the speaker list tonight, Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, Attorney General Josh Shapiro, City Council President Darrell Clark, and Mayor Jim Kenney, who yesterday on Twitter called the shooting in Las Vegas an unspeakable tragedy. In addition to the 59 people who were killed, Stephen Paddock, the gunman, as you've read, is responsible for injuring 500 more in what's being considered the worst mass shooting in modern history. Dave?
Thanks, Aaron.
Thanks, Dave.
WHYY's Aaron Moselle on hand at the Thomas Paine Plaza in Center City, Philadelphia. Beyond vigils, sympathies, thoughts, and prayers, what words can offer perspective and comfort, especially in the realization that we're going to offer similar sympathies, thoughts, and prayers the next time, and the next time, and the next time? Joining me with perspective is Penn Chaplain Reverend Charles L. Howard. Reverend Howard, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Blessing to be here, man.
What have you conveyed to the Penn campus?
I think the conversations we're having on campus are around, one, understanding what we're feeling, being present and being aware of what's going on inside of us, while also being hyper-aware of what's going on in the world. And I think choosing to respond in healthy ways to that. I mean, I think the old phrase of when things threaten our well-being, our heart, or whatever, there's sort of fight or flight. I think very often we see people who fly away and try to escape physically or via social media or other distractions, or they kind of get in this angry mode of trying to place blame on people. I think what I've seen from our students in response to mass shooting, hurricanes, the earthquake, at our best, is this responding in love and doing something fruitful, whether it's, you know, the fundraisers done by students, or not only vigils, but awareness-raising activities. So doing more than offering thoughts and prayers, and as a religious person, I see great value in prayers and great value in intentional thought. But there's more than that that we can do. We can put legs on our faith and do something about it. And that's what I see our young people modeling best.
So it's that sense of hopelessness that in part can fuel either disconnect or rage, but you're offering action.
I think so. I think it's the best way to respond to fear. You know, I think in a lot of ways, not only terrorist acts are terrifying and fear-inducing, but terrible weather is also something that inflicts fear in us. And I think you're right, that the best way to respond to that fear, that hopelessness, is by acting and doing good and loving, I think.
Though some are positing that the best therapy, at least in the short run, is to disconnect, stop paying hyper-attention to TV and Twitter and the onslaught of news reports, whether it's on horrific shootings or hurricanes or all the news that's happening in the world, it seems to have a cumulative effect.
I think you're right. I mean, and it's a small nuance. We think that sort of reading story after story, listening to story after story is paying attention. That's actually, it's paying attention to the news about a story, which is an important nuance there, that we can become addicted to the news sources that we plug into and hearing that as opposed to really paying attention to an incident. So it's one thing to read a lot about Puerto Rico or Mexico or the Virgin Islands or Las Vegas or Houston or Miami. It's another thing to pay attention to Houston or Miami, to pay attention to gun violence. You can scroll and find out new stories, new angles going on in what happened in Vegas. It's another thing to look through that about the tragedy of gun violence and our obsession with gun culture in this country. That's having a healthy awareness as opposed to an escaping awareness about an issue.
So what are some of the ways one can transcend getting lost in the particulars of a particular news story versus more therapeutically looking at the overall issue and then acting accordingly?
I think by talking to humans. And so my sister lives in Houston. And understandably, I was obsessed with what's going on. I'm trying to find out what's happening in her particular neighborhood. And I'm going from news source to news source. It was very different when I talked to Amy herself. Or similar to what happened over the weekend in Vegas. It's heartbreaking. It's scary. And I think my knee-jerk reaction is to find out more about what happened. And then I want to hear what our leaders are saying. It's another thing to have a conversation with someone about what do you think about gun violence in our country? I would love to hear your thoughts on it. I would love to voice what I'm feeling about this. And what can we do about it? That's a healthier way of paying attention, I think, than just ironically escaping through the news about an item. It's safer. It's a little further distance than getting really into it and really feeling it.
In that context, the vigil that we just heard Aaron Mozell report on is a form of community and church, person to person, in flesh rather than through a screen.
Yeah. I know some people sort of see it as trite, the notion of thoughts and prayers or the notion of lighting a candle and standing in a circle. And what change is really happening when we're doing that, when we're having these half-hour vigils? I think a lot of change happens. After Charlottesville, our neighbor, we live in the suburbs over in Lower Merion, and there was a sort of anti-hate gathering. And I brought my girls to this, and they got to see people come together and put their arms around each other and cry together. And did policy change because of the half hour we spent sitting in a park in Lower Merion? No. But hearts did. And it instilled hope in my kids who were beginning to feel a little bit hopeless.
Reverend, thanks so much for sharing perspective on NewsWorks tonight.
Well, thanks for the work y'all are doing down here.
University of Pennsylvania Chaplain Reverend Charles Howard. Chester County resident Anel Medina wanted to be a nurse since she was a teenager, but there was a problem. Her mom brought her to the country illegally when she was 5 years old.
I got all my prereqs out of the way, so I was basically just waiting for something to happen.
That something turned out to be Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, allowing Medina to legally pursue nursing. As the Trump administration moves to end that program, WHYY's Laura Benshoff reports that healthcare providers are rallying behind the 20,000 DACA recipients like Medina working in that field.
Sister Carol Keehan heads up the Catholic Health Association of the United States. Along with 15 hospital CEOs, she wrote a concerned letter to President Trump after he decided to end DACA.
It is throwing some of the finest talent in our country out of our country for something that they had absolutely no ability to control.
The American Medical Association, which represents doctors in the U.S., also raised concerns, saying a permanent DACA program would help offset a growing shortage of physicians. Filling these positions is even harder in rural areas. Elisa Jones runs a federally qualified health center in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania.
We're a little too far from some of the metropolitan areas, such as Philadelphia or Baltimore. So we're recruiting from a very local Chester County recruitment pool.
She says between 5 and 10 people on staff at the health center, called La Comunidad Hispana, have DACA. And that background helps them relate to other patients at the center, which serves low-income people and those without insurance in English and Spanish.
They bring a unique perspective. They bring a cultural competency for serving vulnerable populations that we otherwise would not have.
Anel Medina, the nurse, says that's exactly what drove her to where she is now, working the night shift in an oncology ward. She says growing up around undocumented mushroom pickers like her mom taught her the importance of good health care.
Seeing her and her peers get, you know, sick with a cold or back pain or even the yearly mammograms that women need to have, and always feeling like they weren't being reached.
She says she doesn't have a plan B if DACA runs out without a permanent replacement, but she hopes it will still involve giving back to the immigrant community where she grew up. Laura Benchoff, WHYY News.
Federal prosecutors and defense lawyers delivered opening statements in Philadelphia today in the immigration fraud trial of a Liberian-born man accused of hiding his past as a war criminal. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, attorneys for the man known in Liberia as Jungle Jabba say the government is relying on testimony from members of a rival tribe who are fabricating stories to put him in jail.
Government lawyers told the jury that Mohammed Jabate lied to seek safe haven in the U.S. He told officials he was a member of the Liberian Secret Service, who was later persecuted by former President Charles Taylor on his asylum application, and it was granted. When Jabate settled in Delaware County 20 years ago and started a business, he left behind a secret past life. Assistant U.S. Attorney Nelson Thayer said this included looting, raping, and murdering defenseless villagers and diamond and gold miners along the hills of western Liberia. Some 250,000 people died in the civil wars in Liberia that ended in 2003, but the country has never prosecuted a war criminal. Journalist T.T. Garbo came to Philly from Monrovia, Liberia's capital, because Liberians are closely following the trial.
The vast majority of the people believe that people who have committed atrocities must pay for their actions, or what we had as a war in the country will not repeat itself.
But to Jabate's defense lawyer, Gregory Pagano, it's suspicious that witnesses took so long to come forward. Pagano says it was only when, quote, the world superpower came to Liberia did his, quote, mortal enemies start speaking out against him. Advocates of survivors of the Liberian Civil War say many did come forward, but nothing came of it. Nasheen Sakharati is a lawyer who represents victims of mass atrocities at the San Francisco-based Center for Justice and Accountability. She's been watching the trial.
There isn't any justice available within Liberia, so the only time we can see these individuals being prosecuted right now is in the United States or in a foreign country where these laws are available. So it's very important that these cases proceed.
Most of the trial will center on witnesses testifying about gruesome massacres. But Jabate is being charged essentially with paperwork crimes for lying on immigration documents by not revealing all the violent details of his life as a rebel commander. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
Federal Environmental Protection Agency Administrator Scott Pruitt has made headlines for attempting to roll back protections during his time on the job. Some of those moves have been rebuffed by the courts. Meanwhile, former EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy is in Philadelphia today, accepting the Carnot Prize for Achievement in Energy Policy from the University of Pennsylvania. State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips spoke with McCarthy and asked her opinion of the current administrator.
I think everybody always thinks that when they're going to run into me that I'm going to be depressed somewhere in a corner. I'm not. You know, I am filled with great hope for a number of reasons. One is I go to the University of Pennsylvania and you see the students' faces. You know, they want the environment to be clean. They want public health to be protected. And they'd like their kids to have a really bright future. So the core values that created EPA led it to a really bipartisan support, all of its 47 years of existence, still remains. We still care about these things.
I mean, do the staff members, are they still working on these issues? Like what, I mean, it's hard to know when you hear the rhetoric from the administration, roll back this, you know, roll back that. Like, what's actually happening on the ground? Well, that's what people want to know, I think.
I think you need to understand that this administration tried to take some shortcuts. They tried to say, I can get rid of this and I can make some changes without following the procedures that ensure good public input. And when they did that, the court slapped it down and said, you know, you just can't decide unilaterally. There is a process to follow in governance in the United States, and it involves significant public comment. And rules take a long time. And in order to get rid of a rule, you have to do a rule. And that rule has to provide a reason why you want to turn the world on its head and create more uncertainty by overturning a final rule. So you have to say the science was wrong, didn't get the law right, the facts are different. And I will guarantee you, with the work that we did in the prior administration, that we looked at the science, we looked at the law, we went and searched out public comment high and low, and we responded to those. So I think this administration is going to have a very tough time beyond making pronouncements and actually rolling back fundamental protections that this country is relying on. And the sole criteria they seem to be looking at is whether it costs business money, not whether there were public health benefits. So, if they're not listening to their career staff who really understand the issues and the courts and the law and the science, if they're not listening to them, then they're going to have difficulties finding a way to roll back these fundamental protections.
That's former EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy speaking with State Impact Pennsylvania's Susan Phillips. Cleaning up the heroin encampments along the Conrail tracks in North Philadelphia has left many homeless drug users looking for a new refuge. At one time, there were as many as 125 people living around the site known as El Campamento. While working to get them treatment and shelter, the city is expanding a program to give opioid users their own place to live, even before they get clean. For WHYY's Behavioral Health Desk, Joel Wolfram reports.
Just a few weeks ago, Israel Reyes was sleeping under a bridge near the Conrail tracks. But now he has an airy studio apartment in East Kensington, outfitted with modern black furniture and framed pictures of his grown children.
This is the living room. This is my bed over here, you know.
You have a bike?
Yes. This is my car right here. That's my ride, my bike.
It's comfortable, and most importantly, it's free of the dangers of living at the tracks.
People trying to rob you, trying to hurt you. Rats walking over you.
The apartment and the furnishings were provided by Pathways to Housing PA.
They got me out of that under that bridge. And I'm doing fine so far, you know.
Pathways uses what's called a housing first approach. Its program for people with severe opioid addiction is one of the first of its kind in the country.
The old thinking used to be that you had to be quote-unquote housing ready. You had to be clean and sober in order to earn your way into housing. And the new thinking is come as you are, just come in, and we'll work little by little and get you where you need to go.
That's Liz Hirsch, the director of Philadelphia's Office of Homeless Services. The city is funding 17 new Housing First units as part of its plan to seal off the Conrail tracks where Reyes used to sleep. The cleanup has made even more obvious how many people addicted to opioids in the Kensington neighborhood need housing. Hirsch says between 200 and 300 people are homeless on the streets of Kensington, and that the homeless population has grown citywide in the past 2 years.
It appears that the opioid crisis is the main driver behind the growth in numbers on the street that we've seen.
With the new units, the number of people served by the Pathways program will grow to 75. The Pathways team gathers around a conference table every morning at their office off of North Broad Street. There's a psychiatrist, substance abuse specialists, a peer mentor, and several caseworkers. Most of the people in the program are still using drugs, and sometimes the caseworkers catch them doing that in their units.
I observed it Tuesday, and I just believe that we're going to run into some challenges with him and people using his unit.
Some clients have ended up in jail. Others try to dodge the Pathways staff when they come to visit. The team is ready to connect participants to doctors, therapists, and treatment providers, but they aren't required to accept any help. The only condition that comes with the apartment is to agree to meet with caseworkers. The University of Pennsylvania's Dennis Culhane says the Pathways program represents a new direction for a Housing First initiative.
A lot of the Housing First programs initially focused on people who have severe mental disorders. They've less frequently targeted people who are primarily with a substance use disorder.
Culhane is a professor of social policy whose research focuses on homelessness and supportive housing. He says the research on Housing First shows that these programs are very good at keeping people off the street. Studies have found that 80 to 85% of participants are still living in their apartments after 2 years. but the results relating to substance use are inconclusive.
And so there's not any real strong evidence that the housing placement is leading to recovery.
Experts like Culhane say there just hasn't been enough research on housing first programs for people with substance use disorders to know whether it's a reliable route to recovery. Pathways has found so far that 42% of its opioid team clients are in treatment or otherwise staying clean. Many others say they're interested in starting treatment. Israel Reyes is one of them, but the staff is having a hard time getting a solid commitment from him. Sitting in his apartment with caseworker Nancy Falcon, he says he wants to get on the medication Suboxone, which helps deal with cravings and withdrawal. Then he drops some surprising news.
I'm on Suboxone.
You're currently on Suboxone?
Yeah, I'm currently on Suboxone, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
This throws Falcon for a loop. He's already been taking Suboxone without her knowledge. But whatever treatment he's getting doesn't seem to be working, since he still uses heroin sometimes. He and Falcon agree to go to an intake center that afternoon to find out his options. But getting totally off of drugs isn't necessarily the goal. Housing first is considered a harm reduction approach. Its first priority is not sobriety, but to reduce the dual harms of street life and severe addiction. That makes it controversial. Pathways clinical director Matt Tice stresses that the program isn't right for everyone.
We tend to see the people who have some of the most severe need, or that there are some of the most vulnerable.
Housing First is just one tool Liz Hirsch says the city is using to help homeless opioid users. They also offer temporary shelters, inpatient residential treatment, and other programs that work more gradually toward a permanent home. But Hirsch says altogether, it's still not enough.
We are a resource-constrained system. I think of it as a fire hose problem trying to funnel into a drinking straw-sized system.
As the effects of the opioid crisis worsen in places like Kensington, that system is being put to the test. For WHYY, Joel Wolfram.
NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.